All right, we are back with Freedom Rings. I'm Kenneth John. The phone number here is 847-931-1410. And like right now, I'd like to welcome to Freedom Rings. I am honored to have as our guest Mr. Joseph Bannister. Joe, how are you doing?
Having me.
I am absolutely honored to have you on. To me, you're an absolute American hero. And even though through the mainstream media, people don't know it yet. Welcome your attorney, Mr. Bob Bernhoff.
Yes, good morning, Kenneth. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Really pleased to be here with Joe.
Wonderful. Okay, first, I think what we need to do is just, and I've given just a little preface to our listeners of what this is about, but Joe, I'd like you, in about 15 minutes, if you can, tell us your story. How you got, how you became to be an IRS agent and what happened and when you started doing some research and what you found out and, all that.
Okay. Well, I'm about 42 years old, married with two boys, 17 and 14. But quite a few years ago, 1986, graduated from college, San Jose State University with a degree in accounting, accounting firm called KPMG, which is huge firm, but there was an office in San Jose. I worked there for 3 years in both the tax and the audit departments, and basically working to get my experience to qualify to be a certified public accountant, which I met all the qualifications by 1991. At that point, I was working in the private industry. I'd left KPMG. I was basically a controller for a large venture capital firm, and I decided, had some relatives and friends who were in law enforcement, and decided that that looked like an interesting career. And so, despite the fact that I was more of a bean counter, law enforcement applied to both the FBI and the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. I don't even know if most people know that the IRS has a criminal division to it, but it's staffed with about 3,000 special agents, as they're called, who are criminal investigators investigating violations of the federal income tax and money laundering laws.
Right.
So by 1993, it took quite a long time to apply to both FBI and IRS. FBI, due to a hiring freeze, was not able to hire me, although I did pass through all of the rigorous evaluation, background checks and all that kind of thing, but they just weren't able to actually hire me. Meanwhile, the IRS contacted me in the summer of 1993, interviewed with them, and ended up being extended an offer, and he accepted the offer and was sworn in as a special agent or criminal investigator for the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. Went to training in January of 94. There's a 16-week training that occurs in Glencoe, Georgia, which is near the Florida-Georgia border. There's a law enforcement training center there called Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. So I received the standard training that any criminal investigator would receive from the Secret Service, the FBI. I was president of both my training classes, received about a 94-95% academic average, expert in firearms, and so by April-May of 1994, was sent back to my post of duty, which ended up being San Jose, California, and began work as an IRS criminal investigator, and worked there throughout 94, 95, 1996. And at the end of 1996, I was listening to a talk radio show, as I routinely did, and they had, it was a show out here in San Francisco area, and a lady named D.V. Kishin, KSFO, and she said that the federal income tax was largely a voluntary system. She spoke about the 16th Amendment not being ratified and about our monetary system.
You must have thought this is really wacko stuff.
I did. I mean, I was literally, I remember driving in my government car, which they issued to each investigator, going out doing interviews of witnesses, and I just tuned in the radio as I was driving along, and you know, we special agents. I had a Sig Sauer 9mm strapped to my left hip, and here's this woman on the radio saying that the income tax is voluntary. So, you know, based on my training and, of course, my outlook and beliefs about the income tax, I thought that it was craziness. However, the host who had had her on the show over a prior two-year period, I found to be extremely truthful. You know, he didn't really seem to be a partisan, you know, like everything that Republicans do is right or everything that Democrats do is right. He just was about the Constitution, about the truth, about exposing corruption. So then when he had this woman on, I thought to myself, either I don't have very good investigative skills and I can't read people, or there's something to this. And I really didn't want there, you know, either one of those to be right. But nonetheless, it made me begin to look at the DV Kid made. That was January of 1997. And so, you know, special agents, I believe they still do, they work 50-hour work weeks as opposed to 40, and then they get a little extra bump in their pay. So, I mean, I had fairly long work weeks, two children, a wife, and so every chance I got, I would try to verify or investigate these claims that DV Kid had made. And I just couldn't believe, you know, the volume of information. The learning curve for me, you know, to learn about the history of the income tax from the inception of the 16th Amendment and application of the tax and the Internal Revenue Code, which is, you know, thousands of pages long, Code of Federal Regulations, which supports the Internal Revenue Code, is thousands of pages long. But nonetheless, I had a, you know, decent amount of training as a certified public accountant about how to research. Of course, the IRS trusted me to carry a gun and a badge around, you know, so I had enough competence, I believe, to at least look into this issue. And I to my surprise, after about 2 years of part-time, you know, evenings, weekends, vacation days, I concluded that largely her claims were correct when you looked at the Supreme Court cases on the topic. The actual language of the statutes and the regulations, and really a lot of the IRS's own literature and internal revenue manuals, things like that, that I couldn't help but conclude that there was some real merit to this claim about the limited application of the tax. But again, I thought, I'm not, you know, Supreme Court justice or don't have a law degree. Perhaps I've made an error. So what I did is I approached my supervisors at the IRS, my group manager, Robert Guarini, the chief of our division, Paul Varville, and requested that they evaluate a report that I had put together and show me the error of my analysis, if any.
Sure they straightened you out then.
Well, you know, I realized that this was quite a tumultuous subject and request, but nonetheless, I hearken back to the oath that I took to support and defend the Constitution, and it may sound, you know, corny, but I mean, that was what I believed was my foundation, my rudder, and my guidance as to what I should do. And, you know, I didn't go to the papers or anything. It was just going to my bosses and
right.
saying, look, I didn't expect to come to this conclusion, but I have, and I want to do a good job, I want to do the right thing. So help me, you know, you guys also took an oath. We should be able to figure this out. And the way they figured it out was to call me into the chief's office and basically ask that I resign without any answers to my question whatsoever.
This has to be amazing. I mean, it's not that surprising to those of us who are knowledgeable about these matters, but to those who aren't, this has to be absolutely amazing. You one would think they would just point to the part of the code that requires people to file and pay tax return and pay the taxes.
Well, especially now, I mean, we're, you know, 6 years out. I mean, your show doesn't have time to go into it all, but I mean, yes, you would think that it would be so much simpler, especially with all the complaining that the IRS does about all these questions and all these tax protesters. And, you know, it would seem to me that someone in my capacity, even if they want to, you know, beat me over the head with how stupid I was and how could I possibly come to this conclusion, I mean, I'm a humble enough person that I would have accepted that, but I would have also liked to hear the answer, you know, the actual explanation of why a person of my competence and experience would sincerely conclude that there was some merit to this claim. But of course, if you don't have the answer, or you don't, they don't like the answer that they'd have to give, then, you know, send me out the door with no answer because they have no other choice.
Now, you don't sound like some right-wing crazy nutcase. You're not calling from a bunker in Montana, are you?
Definitely not. I actually come from a family of public servants. My father served for 30 years for the city of San Jose in its public works department. I've got two younger brothers who are police officers, one of whom's a sergeant. You know, I've got the third brother is a captain in a fire department. No, absolutely.
This is amazing, and I'm cutting a little ahead, but I have to. Obviously, 60 Minutes must have contacted you by now, and they're going to probably do the next show of America. What you have found and what's going on, right?
Well, you may not know that 60 Minutes too actually did do.
Oh, they did.
an interview about 3 or 4 years ago. I think it was 2001, but it turned out to be an absolute hit piece.
Oh, right, of course.
They told me that. Oh, we want to get some footage of you with your family and your kids. What do you do with your kids? And I said, well, I skateboard with them. So they got footage.
you mean take them for shooting practice every Saturday morning and camouflage?
Well, once in a while, but mostly skateboarding. So the 60 Minutes got this footage of me skateboarding, and when they first introduced me on the show, they cut to this take of me skateboarding and doing 360s. So, of course, you know, from the start, they tried to make me look like some kind of a crackpot, even though the story was that I was just supposed to look like the regular guy, the family guy, and what do I do with my kids? And they ended up trying to make me look like a skateboarding CPA, I guess.
All right, let's get back to the story. So you were terminated. What happened after that?
Well, I just continued. Of course, I was very frustrated to not get answers. Most people... I knew of many people that had written letters to their congressmen, to the IRS, trying to get answers, and I thought this was, you know, an excellent opportunity for someone inside the agency to sincerely approach the officials there and try to get this resolved. I ended up encountering a group called We the People Foundation, who was going back to Washington, D.C. They were putting in full-page ads in the USA Today, trying to pressure the government officials to come and answer questions.
Just answer questions.
The tax. And it was just amazing. Of course, I can give people some websites later about how to learn about all the ways that the government has avoided. It'd almost be comical if it wasn't such a serious matter.
Right.
Avoided answering simple questions. I mean, certainly complex, the tax code, but then again, if they're the ones enforcing and administering it, it shouldn't be too much to ask as, you know, to how they're doing it and why. And the government is just incredibly reticent to get into a debate or even discussion about the application of the tax vis-a-vis the language of the laws passed by Congress.
So, okay, so you started associating and educating people on what you've discovered?
Yes, I mean, I spent many years...
And eventually you probably got a knock at the door by some of your colleagues.
Well, eventually. It was February of 99 when I left the IRS, and all the way until basically 2001, I just would go around speaking, and you know, I've always made it a practice not to tell people what to do, because you know, I know that the IRS is just—they like to destroy people's lives, frankly. And so I'm not out there.
Well, that's just their job, though. They don't really like to do that, do they?
Well, I gotta wonder about some of them, but you know, I wasn't beating a drum about telling people not to file or pay. It's decision that each person, they have to look at the law and do what the law requires of them. Engaged in First Amendment activity and telling my story. And yes, eventually I did get a knock on the door. The first came through letters where the IRS was trying to basically what they call disbar me or prevent me from assisting clients with IRS matters.
Huh.
And that appeared to be kind of a fishing expedition to, simultaneously with a criminal investigation that I learned later. And it did end up with a knock on my door from agents that I used to work with in November of 2001. And that's when I knew, of course, when the knock on the door comes, I know as a former special agent that then there is a full-blown criminal investigation against the person, and there was one against me. And that led to, in November of 2004, which would be quite a long investigative period, to an indictment. Where I was indicted for the United States and for filing 3 false federal income tax returns. And I was looking at a statutory maximum of 14 years in prison and $1 million in fines. And so this is that was the reward, early reward, for me trying to sincerely ask some questions, abide by my oath, and just try to get to the bottom of this. And of course, being a trained investigator, that's kind of what I do. But it ended up being ending in an accusation that I was a lawbreaker, a felon, and I deserved to be put in prison for many years.
Well, it's kind of interesting, a parallel case of Bill Benson, who was a special criminal investigator for the only state tax people, I believe. And he during the enactment of the 16th Amendment, I wrote a book called The Law That Never Was, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Yes.
He got knocked on the door, too.
Yes, he did. In fact, if we have time, Bob Bernhoff's firm is actually still assisting Mr. Benson with some incredible litigation. And it actually results from the IRS coming out and trying to discredit and imprison people who have the truth.
Aren't they trying to shut the squelch of even the book now? Do I understand correctly, Bob, that the IRS is trying to stop him from distributing the book?
It's not clear, Kenneth, exactly what their agenda is. Mr. Bannister did receive a letter from IRS, and it appeared from the letter, although the letter wasn't very artfully drafted, that they're initiating another investigation of Joe as a precursor to attempting to get an injunction against him under Section 7408 of the Code. I'm very familiar with those sorts of injunction suits. Presumably they would seek, as part of that injunction, to prohibit him from distributing his written report, his 99-page report that was submitted to Treasury Department and IRS attorneys for answers.
Well, excuse me,
remember that Joe,
I don't mean to interrupt, but doesn't the First Amendment say Congress shall make no law abridging free speech?
One of the problems with the tax code as it exists today, putting aside the problem that it's probably a walking, talking due process violation in and of itself,
right,
is that when you move away from the core doctrine of how the tax was supposed to be applied and enforced, and you start doing things as a matter of administrative and bureaucratic convenience and policy convenience, you start bumping up against fundamental legal principles like the right of First Amendment speech. And, we really do have, we've created tax exceptions to very fundamental aspects of our Bill of Rights and our organic rights. And there's no doubt that there has been a tax exception created to the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, and probably others, but those three in particular.
Ninth, I would think.
Well, the 14th. Ninth and Tenth, the courts have been loath to interpret, as you probably know, Kenneth,
yes,
because they're loaded with meaning and power for the average citizen. And what you have here is really a government apparatus that is going out there to squelch dissent. They are going out there, as the old Scots used to say, they're out there taking heads. And they tried to take Joe Bannister's head by indicting him on 4 very serious felony counts in Sacramento Federal District Court. And Joe went to trial on June 14th of this year.
And let's go and let's take the story from there, Joe.
I was indicted in November of 2004, and so I had about 7 months to prepare for trial. And a competent attorney, group of attorneys, and felt that Mr. Bernhoff, who's from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and a gentleman named Jeff Dickstein, who's originally from Southern California and then Oklahoma, but who had relocated to Milwaukee as well, that they were the best in the country, bar none, as far as people who understood you know, what my research was about, what the bigger issues was about, and just, you know, criminal defense work. I mean, knowing how a prosecution would go about trying to do their case, and, you know, I wanted them on many, many levels because they understood the issues involved as far as the tax, about my beliefs, but also just the most incredible you could have to know all the little dirty tricks that a prosecutor might try, and there were plenty of them. One of the things they tried to do was to actually exclude Mr. Bernhoff from my defense team. That was one of the things.
So much for right to counsel.
Yeah, Sixth Amendment, right.
Yeah, just incredible. But the trial did occur in June. Of course, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. You know, but it really, it's amazing when you appreciate your rights. Well, some of us appreciate our rights even without having them attacked. But when they are attacked, of course, my First Amendment rights were being attacked by this prosecution at all. But then once you're in it and you realize that, wow, I actually at least get a jury, you know, people, regular people to listen to about my conduct and evaluate it. When you see the hatred in the prosecutor's eyes and, you know, the judge, who I believe was really fair, was pretty fair, but there's just this apparatus, this mechanism that just wants to devour you, and you feel very fortunate for the people that, you know, fought and died for the right to a jury, to the right to counsel, testify against yourself. It really manifests itself when you're attacked like that, and, you know, again, I appreciated those things, I think, beforehand, but, I mean, to actually have it there was an amazing experience. But things in the trial, you know, of course, I could go on and on. I know you're limited on time, but I'll tell you at least one event that was just amazing. There was a prosecutor that I used to work with when I was doing my own tax investigations for the IRS, and the government had subpoenaed him to testify as their witness to the fact that I had never brought up these particular topics about the particular section of the Internal Revenue Code. And I guess apparently by my never bringing it up, that somehow meant that I wasn't sincere in my beliefs as to my conduct. And I'm not quite sure why the government thought this would be useful testimony. But then right at the last minute before he took the stand, of course, the government's required to give any prior statements that he had made about me. And so they provided us with an email that this prosecutor had sent to his boss back in 2001. Result of a request that I had made of this prosecutor to go to the Department of Justice for which he worked and find some official somewhere, and you know the Department of Justice has thousands of people, to help me with these questions, to answer my questions and the questions of my colleagues and associates about this income tax.
Right.
And I said, if you can't find someone, perhaps even you would do it yourself. You know, because he had a law degree. He actually used to work for the same CPA firm I did. He was a CPA also, a very competent gentleman named Tom DeLeonardo. And unbeknownst to me, he actually complied with my request and emailed his boss, who was the chief of all criminal tax prosecutions for the entire Western United States. Hmm. And this email asked Mr. Cimino, this chief of the Western United States, to basically meet with me or answer my questions, and that he felt that I would listen. And so this email ended up being a huge part of my case, and a pivotal issue for the jury was to show my sincere day one and how the government from day one was so reticent to answer the questions. This Ron Cimino didn't even send an email response back to Mr. DeLeonardo. And here it is, this significant issue. And you'd think maybe just a response that said, no, this guy's a crackpot, or he's not sincere, I don't believe you, I don't have time. Nothing. He didn't even respond to an email from his subordinate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the jury, who actually a couple of the jurors were interviewed after the trial, and they agreed to be interviewed on camera, And, of course, that's going to be some of the materials that I'm going to be distributing here pretty soon. We've been getting them ready for mass production because it's just astounding, the jury explaining how they couldn't understand why this case was brought in the first place. The government had no evidence. Any evidence that they did produce made me look excellent. And they couldn't understand why the government would be, you know, providing evidence that would make me look so good. And I just told them, you know, I said, well, that's all the evidence they have because, you know, I've always been concerned that my conduct was lawful and that I was doing things legally. And so the government tried to make it look like I was this conspirator and doing all these things nefariously. When all the evidence showed that I was simply a CPA trying to do my best to defend my client and just trying to get answers once again. And the jury could see that, and thankfully they unanimously, of course, voted for my acquittal.
On all counts.
And
right.
Yes, and the jurors actually told me that never was there a vote taken where any juror voted for guilt. So
that's
words,
really pretty incredible, but that's kind of amazing.
No one had to be brought over to the other side. Wow. They just wanted to be certain. They looked at some of the evidence, including some of the video testimony, a second time. But when all was said and done, it was a vote 12-0 for acquittal.
All right, we're talking with Joseph Bannister and Bob Bernhoff. The phone number here is 847-931-1410. If you have any comments, questions, observations, analyses, give us a call. We'll be back after a few messages.
We reduce children to their lowest common denominator.
57% of us are functionally illiterate.
For us, excellence is a thing of the past.
We killed the teachers and students at Columbine.
We are all trained to follow orders good.
We have learned to be tolerant of all people, except whites, Christians, and males.
27% of us are put on drugs.
The rest of us take the illegal ones. Two-thirds of us believe that from each according to his ability to each according to his need is part of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution.
7 out of 10 of us don't know either of the senators in our state.
We just placed 19th out of 21 countries on math scores, ahead of the Ivory Coast and Sri Lanka.
We elected Bill Clinton as president.
And re-elected him.
And 9 out of 10 of us are products of the public schools.
This message paid for by the Illinois Indoctrinators Association.
Ever think that you should be getting more out of your computer? Maybe you need a go-to tech guy. A go-to tech guy is somebody who knows computers inside and out and can help you with yours. John Spazieri is a real go-to tech guy. John Spazieri is a 20-year tech veteran who can help you get more out of your computer. Need email or internet setup and training? Call John. Want to simply learn to do things faster? Call John. John Spazieri comes to your home, works with you one-on-one on your machine, and shows you step-by-step how to do things you've always wanted to do with your computer. Want a new computer system set up? Call John. Need fast, convenient repairs? Call John. Call John Spazieri at area code 630-858-6933. That's 630-858-6933. John Spazieri. Make him your go-to tech guy. I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution. So said Thomas Jefferson. What does this mean? Nothing less than that a juror has more power in a particular case than a judge, congressman, or president, and can judge the law. A juror has the right and power to nullify unjust law by voting not guilty, contrary to the jury instructions that many judges routinely give that jurors must apply the law as given by the judge. This is a very important check on the power of oppressive government. In the past, jury nullification has asserted its historical importance concerning fugitive slave laws of the 1850s, prohibition in the 1920s, and draft cases in the 1960s. oppressive gun laws, tax laws, and drug laws are other instances where the people through its jury said no to government. For more information, call the Illinois Fully Informed Jury Association at 847-426-1974. That's 847-426-1974.
We are back with Freedom Rings, talking with Joseph Banister, former special criminal investigative agent for the IRS, and his attorney, Bob Bernhoff. Joe, let's give out some websites if anybody wants more information on what we're talking about.
Oh, that'd be great. My website is freedomabovefortune.com, all one word, freedomabovefortune.com. Right in the center of the screen is something that says IRS Lockout Update. It's in big blue letters. And people can go there and read, see actually a lot of the documents from the harassment campaign that I've been subjected to the last 4 or 5 years. There will also be soon, there's a mailing list that people can join there if they like, if they would join the list. I'm going to actually be announcing soon the availability of video testimony that was shown in my trial. We've actually received the trial transcripts. The juror interview that I mentioned, the jurors have agreed to be taped and quizzed about their jury experience in my trial. It's just incredible.
Are any of those jurors fearful that there's going to be retaliation to them?
No, they weren't. I mean, I was just really encouraged by their... They were just amazed at what the government was willing to do to someone over this issue.
You know, Kenneth, we had a couple of comments about the trial, and there's a lot that could be said about it. Judge Shub gave us a fair trial, and that's, you know, critical to someone like Joe to communicate to the jury that he didn't willfully, intentionally violate any known legal duty. And Judge Shub gave us a fair trial. It was one of the comments I wanted to make.
That kind of shows, I guess, that there's some hope out there. It's not all completely Kafka suppression.
Well, I'm encouraged by it. You know, what you really have here, though, is you know, it's astonishing, isn't it, that this jury of 12 people who have been indoctrinated since virtually birth,
right,
that they're going to file that 1040 and pay
right.
tax, they listen to the evidence in this case, and they come out. These were very intelligent, thoughtful men and women. And they come out there and they say, you know, we don't know why this prosecution was ever brought. What was the government thinking about here? There was never even one vote where one juror voted for a conviction. You know what this tells me is there's a gap, a moat that is widening between the reality of government prosecutors and the system in general and from the average citizen on the street. The government brought this case because they thought they had a good prosecution. They thought, and Joe commented, why would they put on this videotape of him thoughtfully and intelligently speaking his views about things that are very important to all of us, to these people at this company called SenCal Aviation? Well, it's because they apparently believe that any time you raise your voice in protest against the government, that's a criminal act. And you know, these 12 jurors rejected that. Thank goodness.
Thank goodness for the arrogance of government. Because I think they are so far out of touch with what you're saying and talking about, is that they will pursue these things, and they will tell us that there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and you know, go on and on and on, lie after lie after lie, and maybe, and as you say, this widening gap of the truth versus the propaganda. Maybe people are starting to wake up.
Yeah, those comments are very well taken, Kenneth. And you look at that prosecution, that case, and frankly, the fact that the indictment was brought in the first instance, to me, was personally and professionally revolting. We don't, and the speed and with which this jury came back with its verdict, although it deliberated, obviously, because they were out about 2 days, 2.5 days. And yet they, you know, talking to the jurors afterwards about their method of deliberation, I mean, they deliberated. This was nothing cavalier. And it's quite striking that, you know, the government comes in there and the two assistant United States attorneys who prosecuted the case, And at one point, Judge Shub excoriated the two AUSAs, what we call assistant U.S. attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
He excoriated them for tendering ridiculous jury instructions, just jury instructions that weren't even remotely competent for submission to the jury by the judge. At one point, Judge Shub said, you know, if I gave these what you're requesting here, it would embarrass me. It's striking. And to have a man like Joe Bannister have to defend himself in the first place at a potential statutory maximum risk of 14 years in federal prison is an outrage. I mean, people say this a little bit cavalierly sometimes, but, you know, this is America. Citizens have a right to ask the government questions, and the government has a moral duty to respond in good faith. And when you've got law-abiding, credible, thoughtful men of integrity like Joe Bannister, with his background and his credibility, and submitting a report to lawyers high up in the government saying, where am I wrong here? You know, I'm troubled by this, but maybe I don't get it all. You're the government lawyers that sit on high. Tell me where I'm wrong. And what you get is a code of silence. That's unacceptable. That's un-American. And the average Americans out there get it when they're in a jury. But other Americans better start sitting up and taking notice. Because right now the government has on its menu and on its plate, quote-unquote, tax resistors. But when they think they've had enough with the tax resistors, they'll move on.
Absolutely.
To your favorite issue or that woman's favorite issue.
First they came for the tax resisters.
That's right. And you know what's interesting is some of the people on the jury were politically probably leaned towards the left a bit. And we really like this jury.
I think there's no more hope, to be honest with you. There's more hope for freedom on the left than there is on the right.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting that some of the principled leftists in this country have figured it might be applying its resources and making the tax resisters the object of its affliction. But they can turn their gaze to them and the issues they care about.
We educate the left on economics, and we might restore actual true freedom in this country. I'd like to maybe take a few calls, if you don't mind. We have John. Hello, John.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know if... Bob has gotten any repercussions from the bar associations, from the American or Wisconsin bar.
John, where are you from?
Illinois.
Yeah. I'll be candid with you. I'm not at liberty to comment on that right now. And that's all I can say.
Okay.
Anything else, John?
That's it.
All right. Thank you. Hello, Mike. You're on the air.
Morning, guys. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm really, really enjoying the program there, Kenneth. First, I'd like to say to Robert and Joe, really appreciate you guys coming on and, you know, taking the time. Joe, I just want to commend you for having the courage and the integrity to stand up and do the right thing. You know, you threw away a promising career and put yourself and your family at grave risk, you know, because you had the implicitly right in your view, so I'd like to commend you for that.
Thank you.
And, we're out here, you know, spreading the word, and I'm glad that you guys are. And I just wanted to call in and say thank you, gentlemen. Ken, you're doing a great job down there. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate your call.
Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye.
This is Freedom Rings, talking with Joe Bannister and Bob Bernhoff. We'll be back after a few messages.
Hello, friends. This is Kenneth John, and Freedom Rings need your help. I would like to get back to a two-hour show, but that costs money. You can help by contributing to the Heartland Institute, Illinois' own libertarian think tank, with a tax-deductible contribution. The Heartland Institute is an independent, nonprofit research organization in operation for 17 years. Joseph Bast, Heartland's president, is a frequent guest on this program. 90% of what you contribute to Heartland comes back to Freedom Rings to pay for this ad. By contributing $25 or more, you will receive monthly publications including School Reform News, Environment and Climate News, and The Heartlander, the Heartland Institute's monthly newsletter. So please call 312-377-4000 to contribute and be sure to mention Freedom Rings. That's 312-377-4000. Or you can contribute by credit card on the internet by going to Heartland's website at heartland.org. Again, for your support.
I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution. So said Thomas Jefferson. What does this mean? Nothing less than that a juror has more power in a particular case than a judge, congressman, or president, and can judge the law. A juror has the right and power to nullify unjust law by voting not guilty, contrary to the jury instructions that many judges routinely give that jurors must apply the law as given by the judge. This is a very important check on the power of oppressive government. In the past, jury nullification has asserted its historical importance concerning fugitive slave laws of the 1850s, prohibition in the 1920s, and draft cases in the 1960s. Oppressive gun laws, tax laws, and drug laws are other instances where the people through its jury said no to government. For more information, call the Illinois Fully Informed Jury Association at 847-426-1974. That's 847-426.
Before, answer the question.
Joe Bannister and Bob Hernoff, thank you very much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Kevin.
Okay. Bye. This is from P.J. O'Rourke in his book Holidays in Hell, 1989. The Republicans are the party that says government doesn't work and then gets elected and proves it.